to say, "Master, when I first arrived at the Vardhan in Vardhandur, the twins tested me. They tested my knowledge of the ancient language and of magic in general."
"You told this to Oromis. Why repeat it to me now?"
"Because it occurred to me, the twins asked me to summon the true form of a silver ring. At the time, I didn't know how. Arya explained it to me later. How with the ancient language, you can conjure up the essence of any thing or creature. Yet Oromis never spoke of it, and I was wondering, why not?" Gleda seemed to sigh.
"Summoning the true form of an object is a difficult kind of magic. In order for it to work, you must understand everything of importance about the object in question, even as you must in order to guess the true name of a person or animal. Furthermore, it's of little practical value, and it's dangerous, very dangerous. The spell cannot be structured as a continuing process that you can end at any time. Either you succeed in summoning the true form of an object, or you fail and die. There was no reason for Oromis to have you try anything so risky, nor were you advanced enough in your studies to even discuss the topic."
Aragorn shuddered inwardly as he realized just how angry Arya must have been with the twins to summon the true form of the ring they held. Then he said, "I would like to try it now." Aragorn felt the full force of Gleda's attention focused on him.
"Why?"
"I need to know if I have that level of understanding, even if only for one small thing."
"Again, why?"
Unable to explain with words, Aragorn poured his jumble of thoughts and feelings into Gleda's consciousness. When he finished, Gleda was silent for a while, digesting the flow of information.
"Am I right to say,"
began the dragon,
"that you equate this with defeating Galbatorix? You believe that if you can do this and live, then you might be able to defeat the king?"
"Yes," said Aragorn, relieved. He had been unable to articulate his motivation as clearly as the dragon, but that was exactly it.
"And you are determined to try this?"
"Yes, master."
"It may kill you,"
Gleda reminded him. "I know."
"Aragorn,"
exclaimed Saphira, her thoughts faint in his mind. She was flying high above the camp, watching for possible danger, while he studied with Gleda.
"It's far too dangerous. I won't allow it." "I have to do this," he replied quietly.
To Saphira, but also to Aragorn, Gleda said,
"If he insists, then it is best he tries where I can watch. If his knowledge fails him, I may be able to supply the needed information and save him."
Saphira growled, an angry ripping sound that filled Aragorn's mind. And then from outside the tent, Aragorn heard a fearsome rush of air and startled cries from men and elves as she dove to the ground. She landed with such force, the tent and everything in it shook. A few seconds later, she stuck her head into the tent and glared at Aragorn. She was panting, and the wind from her nostrils ruffled his hair and made his eyes water from the odor of burnt meat.
"You're as thick-headed as a cull," she said.
"No more than you." Her lip curled in a hint of a snarl.
"Why are we waiting? If you must do this, let us be done with it." "What will you choose to summon?"
asked Gleda.
"It must be something you are intimately familiar with."
Aragorn let his gaze drift over the interior of the tent, then down to the sapphire ring he wore on his right hand. Arryn. He had rarely taken the ring off since Ar-Jahad had given it to him from Brom. It had become a part of his body as surely as his arms or legs. During the hours he had spent looking at it, he had memorized every curve and facet, and if he closed his eyes, he could call up an image that was a perfect reproduction of the actual object. But for all that, there was much he did not know about the ring, its history, how the elves had made it, and ultimately, what spells might or might not be woven into its fabric. "No, not Arryn." Then his gaze slid from the ring to the pommel of Brisinger, where the sword stood leaning against the corner of his cot. "Brisinger," he murmured. A muffled whump emanated from the blade, and the sword rose a half-inch out of its scabbard, as if pushed from beneath, and small tongues of flame leaped up from the mouth of the sheath, licking the underside of the hilt. The flames vanished, and the sword slid back into the scabbard, as Aragorn quickly ended the unintentional spell. Brisinger, he thought, utterly certain of his choice. It had been Runan's skill that had crafted the sword, but it was he who had wielded the tools, and he had been joined with the elf smith's mind throughout the process. If there was any one object in the world he understood through and through, it was his sword.
"Are you sure?"
asked Gleda. Aragorn nodded, then caught himself as he remembered the golden dragon could not see him. "Yes, master. A question, though. Is Brisinger the true name of the sword? And if not, do I need its true name for the spell to work?"
"Brisinger is the name of fire, as you well know. The true name of your sword is undoubtedly something far more complicated, although it might very well include Brisinger within its description. If you wish, you could refer to the sword by its true name, but you could just as easily call it Sword and achieve the same result, so long as you maintain the proper knowledge at the forefront of your mind. The name is merely a label for the knowledge, and you do not need the label in order to make use of the knowledge. It is a subtle distinction, but an important one. Do you understand?"
"I do."
"Then proceed as you will."
Aragorn took a moment to collect himself. Then he found the nub in the back of his mind and reached through it to tap his body's store of energy, channeling that energy into the word he spoke. While also thinking about everything he knew of the sword, he said clearly and distinctly, "Brisinger!" Aragorn felt his strength ebb precipitously. Alarmed, he tried to speak, tried to move, but the spell bound him in place. He could not even blink or breathe. Unlike before, the sheathed sword did not burst into flame. It wavered, like a reflection in water. Then in the air next to the weapon, a transparent apparition appeared. A perfect glowing likeness of Brisinger, free of its sheath. As well made as was the sword itself, and Aragorn had never found so much as a single flaw. The duplicate floating before him was even more refined. It was as if he was seeing the idea of the sword, an idea that not even Runan, with all her experience working metal, could hope to capture. As soon as the manifestation became visible, Aragorn was again able to breathe and move. He maintained the spell for several seconds, so he could marvel at the beauty of the summoning, and then he let the spell slip free of his grasp, and the ghostly sword slowly faded into oblivion. In its absence, the inside of the tent seemed unexpectedly dark. Only then did Aragorn again become aware of Saphira and Gleda pressing against his consciousness, watching with steadfast attentiveness every thought that flickered through his mind. Both of the dragons were as tense as Aragorn had ever felt them. If he were to poke Saphira, he guessed she would be so startled she would twist herself in circles.
"And if I were to poke you, nothing would be left but a spear," she commented.
Aragorn smiled and lowered himself onto the cot, tired. In his mind, Aragorn heard a sound like wind rushing across a lonely plain as Gleda relaxed.
"You did well, Shadeslayer."
Gleda's praise surprised Aragorn. The old dragon had given out few enough compliments since he had begun teaching Aragorn.
"But let us not try it again."
Aragorn shivered and rubbed his arms, trying to dispel the cold that had crept into his limbs. "Agreed, master." It was not an experience he was eager to replicate. Still, he felt a deep sense of satisfaction. He had proven without a doubt that there was at least one thing in Alagazia that he could do as well as anyone possibly could, and that gave him hope. On the morning of the third day, Roran arrived back at the Varden, along with his companions, tired, wounded, and travel-worn. Roran's return stirred the Varden from their torpor for a few hours. He and the others with him were given a hero's welcome, but an air of boredom soon settled over the majority of the Varden again. Aragorn was relieved to see Roran. He had known his cousin was safe, as he had scried him several times while he was gone. Nevertheless, seeing him in person freed Aragorn of an anxiety that until that very moment he had not realized he was carrying. Roran was the only family he had left. Murtagh did not count as far as Aragorn was concerned, and Aragorn could not bear the thought of losing him. Now, seeing Roran up close, Aragorn was shocked by his appearance. He had expected Roran and the others to be exhausted, but Roran seemed far more haggard than his companions. He looked as if he had aged 5 years over the course of the trip. His eyes were red and dark-ringed, his brow was lined, and he moved stiffly, as if every inch of his body was covered in bruises. And then there was his beard, which had been burned half off, and which now had a mottled, mangy appearance. The five men, one less than their original number, went first to visit the healers of Duvrangagata, where the spellcasters attended to their wounds. Then they presented themselves to Nasawada in her pavilion. After commending them for their bravery, Nasawada dismissed all of the men, except Roran, whom she asked to deliver a detailed account of his journey to and from Aros, as well as the capture of the city itself. The telling took some time, but both Nasawada and Aragorn, who were standing by her right hand, listened with rapt and sometimes horrified attention while Roran spoke. When he finished, Nasawada surprised both him and Aragorn by announcing that she was placing Roran in charge of one of the Varden's battalions. Aragorn expected the news to please Roran. Instead, he saw the lines in his cousin's face deepen and his brows draw together in a frown. Roran made no objection or complaint, however, but bowed and said in his rough voice, "As you wish, Lady Nasawada." Later, Aragorn walked Roran to his tent, where Katrina was waiting for them. She greeted Roran with such an obvious display of emotion that Aragorn averted his eyes, embarrassed. With Saphira, the three of them dined together, but Aragorn and Saphira excused themselves as soon as they could, for it was obvious that Roran had no energy for company, and Katrina wished to have him for herself. As he and Saphira wandered through the camp in the deepening dusk, Aragorn heard someone behind him shout, "Aragorn! Aragorn! Wait a moment!" He turned to see the thin, gangly figure of the scholar Jode running toward him, strands of hair flying around his lean face. In his left hand, Jode clutched a ragged scrap of parchment. "What is it?" Aragorn asked, worried. "This!" exclaimed Jode, his eyes gleaming. He held up the parchment and shook it. "I've done it again, Aragorn! I've found a way!" In the fading light, the scar on his scalp and temple appeared startlingly pale against his tanned skin. "You've done what again? You've found what way? Slow down! You're not making sense!" Jode glanced around furtively. Then he leaned close to Aragorn and whispered, "All my reading and searching has paid off. I've discovered a hidden tunnel that leads straight into Drasleona." Decisions. "Explain it to me again," said Nasawada. Aragorn shifted his weight, impatient, but he held his tongue. From the piles of scrolls and books in front of him, Jode picked up a slim volume bound in red leather and began his narrative for the third time. "Some 500 years ago, as best I can tell," Jormunda interrupted him with a motion of his hand.
"Leave out your qualifiers. We know this is speculation,"
Jode began again.
"Some 500 years ago, Queen Fauna sent Erst Greybeard to Drasleona, or rather what was to become Drasleona."
"And why did she send him?" asked Nasawada, while she toyed with the fringe of her sleeve.
"The dwarves were in the midst of a clan war, and Fauna hoped that she could secure the support of our race by helping King Radgar with the planning and construction of the fortifications for the city, even as the dwarves engineered the defences for Aros."
Nasawada rolled a strand of cloth between her fingers. "And then Dolgarth Halfstave killed Fauna,
Aye, and Erst Greybeard had no choice but to return to the Beor Mountains as fast as he could to defend his clan from Halfstay's predations. But, Jode held up a finger, before he left, it seems Erst did start on his work. King Radgar's chief advisor, Lord Yardley, wrote in his memoirs that Erst had begun to draw up plans for the sewer system underneath the center of the city, since that would affect how the fortifications would be built. From his place at the far end of the table that filled the middle of Nasawada's pavilion, Oryk nodded and said,
"That's true enough. You have to work out where and how the weight is distributed and determine what's appropriate for the kind of earth you're dealing with. Otherwise, you're liable to have cave-ins."
Jode continued, "Of course, Dras Leona doesn't have underground sewers, so I assume that nothing like Erst's plans were ever put into effect. However, a few pages later, Yardley says..." Peering down his nose at the book, Jode read, "And in a most lamentable turn of events, the Reavers burned many a house and made off with many a family treasure. The soldiers were slow to respond, for they had been put to work underground, laboring like common peasants." Jode lowered the book. "Now, what were they excavating? I was unable to find any further mention of subterranean activities in or around Dras Leona until..." Putting down the red volume, he selected another book, this one a massive wood-paneled tome, nearly a foot thick. "I happened to be perusing the Acts of Taradas and other mysteries of occult phenomena as recorded throughout the ages of men, dwarves, and the most ancient elves, when..." "It is a work filled with mistakes," said Arya. She stood by the left side of the table, leaning on both hands over a map of the city. "The author knew little of my people, and what he did not know, he invented."
"That may be," said Jode, "but he knew a great deal about humans, and it is humans we are interested in."
Jode opened the book close to the middle and gently lowered the upper half to the table, so it lay flat. During his investigations, Othman spent some time in this region. He mainly studied Helgrind and the strange happenings associated with it. But he also had this to say about Dras Leona. "The people of the city also often complain of peculiar sounds and odors wafting up from under their streets and floors, especially at night, which they attribute to ghosts and spirits and other uncanny creatures. But if they are spirits, they are unlike any I have heard of before, as spirits elsewhere seem to avoid enclosed spaces." Jode closed the book. "Fortunately, Othman was nothing if not thorough, and he marked the locations of the sounds on a map of Dras Leona, where, as you can see, they form a nearly straight line through the old part of the city." "And you think this indicates the presence of a tunnel?" said Nasawada.
It was a statement, not a question.
"I do,"
said Jode, bobbing his head. Sitting next to Nasawada, King Orin, who had said little, spoke.
"Nothing you have shown us so far, good man Jode, has yet to prove that this is actually a tunnel. If there is a space under the city, it might very well be a cellar or a catacomb, or some other chamber that only leads to the building above. Even if it is a tunnel, we do not know if it exists anywhere outside of Dras Leona, nor, assuming its existence, where it would lead. To the heart of the palace, perhaps? What's more, by your own account, it's likely the construction of this hypothetical tunnel was never completed in the first place."
"It seems unlikely it could be anything but a tunnel, given its shape, Your Majesty," said Jode. "No cellar or catacomb would be so narrow or long. As for whether it was completed, we know it was never used for its intended purpose, but we also know that it lasted at least up until Othman's time, which means the tunnel or passageway or what have you must have been finished to some degree. Otherwise the seep of water would have destroyed it long ago."
"What of the exit, then? Or the entrance, if you will?" asked the king.
Jode scrabbled among the piles of scrolls for a few moments before pulling out another map of Dras Leona, this one showing a portion of the surrounding landscape.
"That I can't be sure about, But if it does lead out of the city, then it would exit somewhere around here.
He placed his index finger on a spot close to the eastern side of the city. Most of the buildings outside the walls that protected the heart of Drasleona were located on the western side of the city, next to the lake. This meant that the location Jode was pointing at, though empty land, was closer to the center of Drasleona than one could get from any other direction without encountering buildings.
But it's impossible to tell without going there to look for it in person.
Aragorn frowned. He had thought Jode's discovery would be more certain.
You are to be congratulated on your research, good man Jode, said Nasawada. You may have once again performed a great service for the Varden.
She rose from her high-backed chair and walked over to look at the map. The hem of her dress rustled as it dragged across the ground.
If we send a scout to investigate, we risk alerting the Empire to our interest in that area. Assuming the tunnel exists, it would be of little value to us then. Murtagh and Thorn would be expecting us on the other end.
She looked at Jode.
How wide do you think this tunnel would be? How many men could fit in it?
I couldn't say. It might be...
Oric cleared his throat, then said,
The earth here is soft and clay-like, with a fair bit of silt layered through it. Horrible for tunneling. If Erst had any sense, he wouldn't have planned to have one large channel carry away the city's waste. He would have laid down several smaller passageways to reduce the likelihood of a cave-in. I'd guess that none of them would be wider than a yard or so.
Too narrow for more than a single man to pass through at a time, said Jode.
Too narrow for more than a single Nurla, added Oric.
Nasawada returned to her seat and stared at the map with unfocused eyes, as if she were gazing at something far away.
After a few moments of silence, Aragorn said, I could search for the tunnel. I know how to hide myself with magic. The sentries would never see me.
Perhaps, murmured Nasawada.
But I still don't like the idea of having you or anyone else running about. The likelihood of the Empire noticing is too high. What if Murtagh is watching? Could you fool him? Do you even know what he is capable of now?
She shook her head.
No. We must act as if the tunnel exists and make our decisions accordingly. If events prove otherwise, it won't have cost us anything. But if the tunnel is there, it should allow us to capture Drasleona once and for all.
What have you in mind?
Asked King Orin, in a tone of caution.
Something bold. Something unexpected.
Aragorn snorted softly.
Perhaps you should consult Roran, then. I have no need of Roran's help in devising my plans, Aragorn.
Nasawada fell silent again, and everyone in the pavilion, including Aragorn, waited to see what she would come up with. At last, she stirred and said,
This. We send a small team of warriors to open the gates from the inside.
And how's anyone supposed to manage that?
Demanded Oric.
It would be tricky enough if all they had to face were the hundreds of soldiers stationed in the area. But in case you have forgotten, there's also a giant, fire-breathing lizard lounging close by, and he's sure to take an interest in anyone foolish enough to pry open the gates. And that's not even taking Murtagh into account.
Before the discussion could devolve, Aragorn said, I can do it.
The words had an immediate, chilling effect on the conversation. Aragorn expected Nasawada to reject his suggestion out of hand, but she surprised him by considering it. Then she surprised him further when she said,
Very well.
All the arguments Aragorn had built up fell away as he stared at Nasawada with astonishment. She had obviously followed the same chain of reasoning as he had. The tent erupted into a confusion of overlapping voices as everyone began to speak at once. Arya won out over the din.
Nasawada, you cannot allow Aragorn to endanger himself so. It would be unconscionable. Send some of Blodgarm's spellcasters instead. I know they would agree to help, and they are as mighty warriors as any you can find, including Aragorn."
Nazawada shook her head.
"None of Galbatorix's men would dare kill Aragorn. Not Murtagh, not the king's pet magicians, not even the lowest of soldiers. We should use that to our advantage. Besides, Aragorn is our strongest spellcaster, and it may require a great deal of strength to force open the gates. Of all of us, he has the best chance of success." "What if he is captured, though? He can't hold his own against Murtagh, you know that." "We'll distract Murtagh and Thorn, and that will give Aragorn the opportunity he needs."
Arya lifted her chin.
"How? How will you distract them?" "We'll make as though to attack Drusleona from the south. Saphira will fly around the city setting buildings on fire and killing soldiers on the walls. Thorn and Murtagh will have no choice but to give chase, especially since it will appear as if Aragorn is riding Saphira the whole time. Blodgarm and his fellow spellcasters can conjure up a facsimile of Aragorn, as they did before. As long as Murtagh doesn't get too close, he'll never discover our subterfuge." "You are determined in this?"
"I am."
Arya's face hardened.
"Then I will accompany Aragorn."
Relief seeped through Aragorn. He had hoped she would go with him, but he had been uncertain whether to ask, for fear she would refuse. Nazawada sighed.
"You are Islanzadi's daughter. I would not like to place you in such danger. If you were to die, remember how your mother reacted when she thought Durza had killed you. We cannot afford to lose the help of your people."
"My mother..."
Arya clamped her lips shut, cutting herself off. Then began anew.
"I can assure you, Lady Nasawada, Queen Islanzadi shall not abandon the Varden, whatever may happen to me. Of that you need have no concern. I will accompany Aragorn, as will two of Blodgarm's spellcasters."
Nasawada shook her head.
"No, you can only take one. Murtagh is familiar with the number of elves who have been protecting Aragorn. If he notices that two or more are missing, he may suspect a trap of some sort. In any event, Saphira will need as much help as she can get if she's to keep out of Murtagh's grasp."
"Three people are not enough to attempt such a mission," insisted Arya. "We would be unable to ensure Aragorn's safety, much less open the gates."
"Then one of Duvrangar Gata can go with you as well."
A hint of derision colored Arya's expression.
"None of your spellcasters are strong or skilled enough. We'll be outnumbered 100-1 or worse. Both ordinary swordsmen and trained magicians will be arrayed against us. Only elves or riders..."
"Or shades,"
Auric rumbled.
"Or shades,"
Arya conceded, though Aragorn could tell she was irritated.
"Only those could hope to prevail against such odds. And even then it is no sure thing. Let us take two of Blodgarm's spellcasters. No one else is fit for the task, not among the Varden."
"Oh, and what am I, chopped liver?"
Everyone turned to look, surprised, as Angela stepped forward from a corner at the back of the tent. Aragorn had not even suspected she was there.
"What a strange expression," said the herbalist.
"Who would compare themselves to chopped liver in the first place? If you have to choose an organ, why not pick a gallbladder or a thymus gland instead? Much more interesting than a liver. Or what about chopped..."
She smiled.
"Well, I suppose that's not important."
She stopped in front of Arya and looked up at her.
"Will you object if I accompany you, Alpha? I'm not a member of the Varden, not strictly speaking, but I'm still willing to round out this quartet of yours."
Much to Aragorn's surprise, Arya bowed her head and said,
"Of course, wise one. I meant no offence. It would be an honour to have you with us."
"Good," exclaimed Angela. "That is, assuming you don't mind,"
directing her words to Nasawada. Appearing somewhat bemused, Nasawada shook her head.
"If you are willing, and neither Aragorn nor Arya objects, then I can think of no reason why you shouldn't go.
I can't imagine why you'd want to, though."
Angela tossed her curls.
"Do you expect me to explain every decision I make? Oh, very well. If it'll satisfy your curiosity,
Let's say I have a grudge against the priests of Hellgrind, and I'd like the chance to do them some mischief. And besides, if Murtagh puts in an appearance, I have a trick or two up my sleeve that might give him a bit of a turn. We should ask Elva to go with us as well, said Aragorn. If anyone can help us avoid danger. Nasawada frowned. Last we spoke, she made her position clear enough. I'll not go bowing and scraping to her in an attempt to convince her otherwise. I'll talk with her, said Aragorn. I'm the one she's angry with, and I'm the one who should ask her. Nasawada plucked at the fringe of her golden dress. She rolled several strands between her fingers, then abruptly said, Do as you wish. I dislike the thought of sending a child, even one as gifted as Elva, into battle. However, I suppose she is more than capable of protecting herself. As long as the pain of those around her doesn't overwhelm her, said Angela. The last few battles have left her curled in a ball, barely able to move or breathe. Nasawada stilled her fingers and peered at Aragorn with a serious expression. She is unpredictable. If she does choose to go along, be careful of her, Aragorn. I will, he promised. Then Nasawada began to discuss questions of logistics with Orin and Oric, and Aragorn withdrew somewhat from the conversation, for he had little to contribute. In the privacy of his mind, he reached out to Saphira, who had been listening through him to the goings-on. Well, he asked, what do you think? You've been awfully quiet. I thought for sure you would say something when Nasawada proposed sneaking into Drasleona.
I said nothing, because I had nothing to say. It is a good plan.
You agree with her?
We are no longer awkward younglings, Aragorn. Our enemies may be fearsome, but so are we. It is time we remind them of that.
Does it bother you that we'll be apart?
Of course it bothers me, she growled. Wherever you go, enemies flock to you like flies to flesh. However, you are not as helpless as you once were.
And she almost seemed to purr. Me? Helpless? He said with mock outrage.
Only a little bit. But your bite is more dangerous than before.
So is yours.
I go to hunt. A wing-breaking storm is building, and I'll not have a chance to eat again until after we attack.
Fly safely, he said. As he felt her presence receding from him, Aragorn returned his attention to the conversation within the tent, for he knew his life and that of Saphira would depend on the decisions Nasawada, Oric, and Orin would make. Under Hill and Stone. Aragorn rolled his shoulders, trying to get his mail hauberk to rest comfortably under the tunic he wore to hide the armor. Darkness lay all around them, heavy and oppressive. A thick layer of clouds obscured the moon and the stars. Without the red weirlight Angela held in the palm of her hand, even Aragorn and the elves would have been unable to see. The air was humid, and once or twice Aragorn felt a few cold drops of rain strike his cheeks. Elva had laughed and refused when he had asked for her help. He had argued with her long and hard, but to no avail. Saphira had even intervened, flying down to the tent where the witch-child was staying, and placing her massive head just a few feet away from the girl, forcing her to look into one of Saphira's brilliant, unblinking eyes. Elva had not had the temerity to laugh then, but she remained obdurate in her refusal. Her stubbornness frustrated Aragorn. Still, he could not help but admire the strength of her character. To say no to both a rider and a dragon was no small thing. Then again, she had endured an incredible amount of pain in her short life, and the experience had hardened her to a degree rarely seen, even in the most jaded of warriors. Beside him, Arya fastened a long cloak around her neck. Aragorn wore one as well, as did Angela and the black-haired elf, Wirden, whom Blodgarm had chosen to accompany them. The cloaks were needed to protect them against the night chill, as well as to conceal their weapons from anyone they might encounter in the city, if they got that far. Nasawada, Jormunda, and Saphira had accompanied them to the edge of the camp, where they now stood.
Among the tents, the men of the Varden, dwarves and Urgles, were busy preparing to march forth.
"Don't forget," said Nasawada, her breath steaming in front of her. "If you can't reach the gates by dawn, find somewhere to wait until tomorrow morning, and we'll try again then." "We may not have the luxury of waiting," said Arya.
Nasawada rubbed her arms and nodded. She appeared unusually worried.
"I know. Either way, we'll be ready to attack as soon as you contact us, no matter the time of day. Your safety is more important than capturing Drasleona, remember that."
Her gaze drifted toward Aragorn as she spoke.
"We should be off," said Wirden. "The night grows old."
Aragorn pressed his forehead against Saphira for a moment.
"Good hunting,"
she said softly.
"And you as well."
They reluctantly parted, and Aragorn joined Arya and Wirden as they followed Angela away from the camp, heading toward the eastern edge of the city. Nasawada and Jormunda murmured well wishes and farewells as they strode past, and then all was quiet, save the sounds of their breathing and of their boots on the ground. Angela dimmed the light in her palm until it was barely bright enough for Aragorn to see his feet. He had to strain his eyes to spot rocks and branches that lay in the way. They walked in silence for nearly an hour, at which point the herbalist stopped and whispered,
"We're here, as best I can tell. I'm fairly good at reckoning distances, but we might be off by more than 1,000 feet. It's hard to be certain of anything in this gloom."
Off to their left, a half-dozen pinpricks of light floated above the horizon, the only evidence that they were anywhere near Drasleona. The light seemed close enough to pluck from the air. He and the two women gathered around Wirden as the elf knelt and pulled the glove off his right hand, placing his palm against the bare earth. Wirden began to croon the spell he had learned from the dwarven magician, whom ere they left on their mission, Auric had sent to instruct them in the ways of detecting underground chambers. While the elf sang, Aragorn stared into the surrounding blackness, listening and watching for enemies. The fall of raindrops on his face increased. He hoped the weather would improve before battle was joined, if battle was to be joined. An owl hooted somewhere, and he reached for Brisinga, only to stop himself and clench his fist.
"Basil,"
he said to himself, using Auric's favorite curse. He was more nervous than he ought to be. The knowledge that he might be about to fight Murtagh and Thorn again, singly or together, had put him on edge.
"I'll be sure to lose if I keep on like this," he thought.
So he slowed his breathing and initiated the first of the mental exercises Gleda had taught him for establishing control over his emotions. The old dragon had not been enthusiastic about the mission when Aragorn told him about it, but neither had he opposed it. After discussing various contingencies, Gleda had said,
"Beware of the shadows, Aragorn. Strange things lurk in dark places."
Which Aragorn thought was hardly an encouraging statement. He wiped the accumulated moisture off his face, keeping his other hand close to the hilt of his sword. The leather of his glove was warm and smooth against his skin. Lowering his hand, he hooked his thumb under his sword belt, the belt of Beloth the Wise, conscious of the weight of the 12 flawless diamonds concealed within. That morning he had gone to the livestock pens, and as the cooks killed the birds and sheep for the army's breakfast, he had transferred the dying animal's energy into the gems. He hated doing so. When he reached out with his mind to an animal, if it still had its head attached, the animal's fear and pain became his own, and as it slipped into the void he felt as if he himself were dying. It was a horrible, panic-inducing experience. Whenever he could, he had whispered words in the ancient language to the animals in an attempt to comfort them. Sometimes it worked, sometimes not. Though the creatures would have died in any case, and though he needed the energy, he hated the practice, for it made him feel as if he were responsible for their deaths. It made him feel unclean. Now he fancied that the belt was slightly heavier than before, laden as it was with the energy from so many animals. Even if the diamonds within had been worthless, Aragorn would have regarded the belt as valuable beyond gold, on account of the dozens of lives that had gone into filling it. As Wirden ceased singing, Arya asked,
Have you found it?
This way, said Wirden, standing.
Relief and trepidation swept through Aragorn.
Jode was right.
Wirden led them over a road and a series of small hills, then down into a shallow wash hidden within the folds of the land.
The mouth of the tunnel should be somewhere here, said the elf,
and gestured at the western bank of the depression. The herbalist increased the brightness of her wheelite enough for them to search by. Then Aragorn, Arya, and Wirden began to comb through the brush along the side of the bank, poking at the ground with sticks. Twice Aragorn barked his shins against the stumps of fallen birch trees, causing him to suck in his breath with pain. He wished he was wearing braces, but he had left them behind, along with his shield, because they would have attracted too much attention in the city. For 20 minutes they searched, ranging up and down the bank, as they worked their way out from their starting point. At last Aragorn heard a ring of metal, and then Arya softly called,
Here!
He and the others hurried toward her, where she stood by a small overgrown hollow in the side of the bank. Arya drew aside the brush to reveal a stone-lined tunnel, 5 feet tall and 3 feet wide. A rusting iron grate covered the gaping hole.
Look,
Arya said, and she pointed at the ground. Aragorn looked, and he saw a path leading out of the tunnel. Even by the weird red illumination of the herbalist's wheelite, Aragorn could tell that the trail had been worn into place by the passage of tramping feet. One or more people must have been using the tunnel to surreptitiously enter and exit Drasleona.
We should proceed with caution,
whispered Wirden. Angela made a faint noise in her throat.
How else were you planning to proceed? With blaring trumpets and shouting heralds? Really?
The elf refrained from answering, but he appeared distinctly uncomfortable. Arya and Wirden pulled off the grating and cautiously moved into the tunnel. Both conjured wheelites of their own. The flameless orbs floated over their heads like small red suns, though they admitted no more light than a handful of coals. Aragorn hung back and said to Angela,
Why do the elves treat you so respectfully? They seem almost afraid of you. Am I not deserving of respect?
He hesitated.
One of these days, you know, you're going to have to tell me about yourself.
What makes you think that? And she pushed past him to enter the tunnel, her cloak flapping like the wings of a leatherblacker. Shaking his head, Aragorn followed. The short herbalist did not have to bend much in order to avoid bumping into the ceiling, but Aragorn had to hunch like an old man with rheumatism, as did the two elves. For the most part, the tunnel was empty. A fine layer of caked dirt covered the floor. A few sticks and rocks and even a discarded snakeskin were scattered near the mouth of the tunnel. The passageway smelled like damp straw and moth wings. Aragorn and the others walked as quietly as they could, but the tunnel magnified sounds. Every bump and scrape echoed, filling the air with a multitude of overlapping whispers that seemed to murmur and sigh with a life of their own. The whispers made Aragorn feel as if they were surrounded by a host of disembodied spirits who were commenting on their every move.
So much for sneaking up on anyone, he thought, as he scuffed his boot against a rock, which bounced against the side of the tunnel with a loud clack that multiplied 100-fold as it spread through the tunnel. Sorry, he mouthed, as everyone looked at him.
A wry smile touched his lips. At least we know what causes the strange sounds underneath Drasleona. He would have to tell Jode on their return. When they had gone a fair ways down the tunnel, Aragorn paused and looked back at the entrance, which was already lost in darkness. The gloom seemed almost palpable, like a heavy cloth draped over the world. Combined with the close-set walls and low ceiling, it left him feeling cramped and constricted. Normally he did not mind being in enclosed places, but the tunnel reminded him of the warren of rough-hewn passageways within Helgrind, where he and Roran had fought the Razak. Hardly a pleasant memory. He took a deep breath, then released it. Just as he was about to continue forward, he caught a glimpse of two large eyes gleaming in the shadows, like a pair of copper-coloured moonstones. He grabbed Brisinga, and had already drawn the sword several inches from its scabbard, when Solemnbum appeared out of the murk,
padding along on silent paws. The weercat stopped at the edge of the light. He twitched his black-tipped ears, and his jaws parted in what seemed to be an expression of amusement. Aragorn relaxed and acknowledged the weercat's presence with a dip of his head.
I should have guessed.
Wherever Angela went, Solemnbum invariably followed. Again, Aragorn wondered about the herbalist's past. How did she ever win his loyalty? As the rest of the party grew distant, the shadows crept over Solemnbum once more, hiding him from Aragorn's sight. Comforted by the knowledge that the weercat was watching his back, Aragorn hurried to catch up. Before the group left the camp, Nasawada had briefed them on the exact number of soldiers in the city, as well as where they were stationed and their duties and habits. She had also given them details about Murtagh's sleeping quarters, what he ate, and even his mood the previous evening. Her information had been remarkably precise. When questioned, she had smiled and explained that since the Varden had arrived, the weercats had been spying for her within Drasleona. Once Aragorn and his companions emerged within the city, the weercats would escort them to the southern gates, but would not reveal their own presence to the Empire if at all possible, else they would no longer be able to supply Nasawada with intelligence as effectively. After all, who would suspect that the unusually large cat lounging nearby was actually an enemy spy? It occurred to Aragorn then, as he reviewed Nasawada's briefing, that one of Murtagh's greatest weaknesses was that he still had to sleep. If we don't capture or kill him today, the next time we meet, it might help us to find a way to wake him in the middle of the night, and for more nights than one if we could manage it. 3 or 4 days without proper sleep, and he'd be in no fit shape to fight. On and on they went through the tunnel, which ran straight as an arrow, never bending, never turning. Aragorn thought he detected a slight upward slant to the floor, which would make sense, as it was designed to channel waste out of the city, but he was not entirely sure. After a while, the dirt beneath their feet began to soften and stick to their boots like wet clay. Water dripped from the ceiling, sometimes landing on the nape of Aragorn's neck and rolling down his spine, like the touch of a cold finger. He slipped once on a patch of mud, and when he put out a hand for balance, found the wall covered in slime. An indeterminate amount of time passed. They might have spent an hour in the tunnel, they might have spent 10, or maybe it was only a few minutes. Whatever the case, Aragorn's neck and shoulders hurt from standing half-bent over, and he grew tired of staring at what seemed to be the same 20 feet of rose-hued stone. At last he noticed the echoes were waning, and ever more of a delay was appearing between each repetition of the sounds. Soon afterward, the tunnel disgorged them into a large rectangular chamber, with a ridged half-dome ceiling, over 15 feet high at its apex. The chamber was empty, except for a rotting barrel in one corner. Across from them, 3 identical archways opened to 3 identical rooms, small and dark. Where those led, Aragorn could not see. The group stopped, and Aragorn slowly straightened his back, wincing as his sore muscles stretched.
"This would not have been part of Erst Greybeard's plans," said Arya.
"Which path should we pick?" asked Wirden.
"Isn't it obvious?" asked the herbalist. "The left one. It's always the left one."
And she strode toward that self-same arch, even as she spoke. Aragorn could not help himself.
"Left according to which direction? If you were starting from the other side, left..."
"Left would be right, and right would be left, yes, yes," said the herbalist.
Her eyes narrowed.
"Sometimes you're too clever for your own good, Shadeslayer. Very well, we'll try it your way. But don't say I didn't warn you if we end up wandering around here for days on end."
Aragorn would actually have preferred to take the center archway, as it seemed the most likely to lead them up to the streets, but he did not want to get into an argument with the herbalist. "Either way, we'll find stairs soon enough," he thought. "There can't be that many chambers under Drasleona." Holding her weirlight aloft, Angela took the lead. Wirden and Arya followed, while Aragorn brought up the rear. The room through the rightmost archway was larger than it had first appeared, for it extended to the side for 20 feet, then turned and continued for another few yards, whereupon it ended at a corridor studded with empty sconces. Down the corridor was another small room lined with three arches, each of which led to rooms with even more archways, and so on.
Who built these, and why?
Aragorn wondered, bewildered. All the rooms they saw were deserted and empty of furnishings. The only things they found within were a two-legged stool that fell apart when he nudged it with the tip of his boot, and a pile of broken pottery lying in a corner beneath a veil of spiderwebs. Angela never hesitated or seemed confused about which direction to go, but without fail she chose the path to the right. Aragorn would have objected, except that he could think of no better alternative to her method. The herbalist stopped when they arrived at a circular room, with seven equally spaced archways placed along the walls. Seven corridors, including the one they had just traversed, stretched out from the archways.
"Mark where we come from, or we'll get completely turned around," said Arya.
Aragorn went to the corridor, and with the tip of Brisinger's crossguard, scratched a line on the stone wall. As he did, he peered into the darkness, searching for a glimpse of Solombum, but he saw not so much as a whisker. Aragorn hoped the Weircat had not gotten lost somewhere in the maze of rooms. He almost reached out with his mind to find him, but resisted the urge. If anyone else felt him groping around, it might alert the Empire to their location.
"Ah!"
exclaimed Angela, and the shadows around Aragorn shifted, as the herbalist stood on tiptoe and raised her weirlight as high as she could. Aragorn hurried to the center of the room, where she stood with Arya and Wirden.
"What is it?"
he whispered.
"The ceiling, Aragorn,"
murmured Arya.
"Look at the ceiling."
He did as he was told, but saw only blocks of ancient mold-covered stones, crazed with so many cracks. It seemed amazing the ceiling had not collapsed long ago. Then his vision shifted, and he gasped. The lines were not cracks, but rather deeply carved runes, rows of them. They were neat and small, with sharp angles and straight stems. Mold and the passage of centuries had obscured parts of the text, but most of it remained legible. Aragorn struggled with the runes for a short while, but he recognized only a few of the words, and those were spelled differently than he was used to.
"What does it say?" he asked. "Is it dwarvish?"
"No," said Wirden. "It is the language of your people, but as it was spoken and written long ago, and of a very particular dialect, that of the zealot Tosk."
The name struck a chord in Aragorn. "When Roran and I rescued Katrina, we heard the priests of Helgrind mention a book of Tosk." Wirden nodded.
"It serves as the foundation of their faith. Tosk was not the first to offer up prayers to Helgrind, but he was the first to codify his beliefs and practices, and many others have imitated him since. Those who worship Helgrind regard him as a prophet of the divine. And this," the elf cast his arms out wide, "is a history of Tosk, from his birth to his death. A true history, such as his disciples have never shared with those outside their sect."
"We could learn much from this,"
said Angela, never taking her eyes off the ceiling.
"If only we had the time."
Aragorn was surprised to see her so enthralled. Arya glanced at the seven corridors.
"A moment then, but read quickly."
While Angela and Wirden perused the runes with avid intensity, Arya walked over to one of the archways and in an undertone began to chant a spell for finding and locating. When she finished, she waited a moment with her head cocked, then moved on to the next archway. Aragorn stared at the runes a bit longer. Then he returned to the mouth of the corridor that had brought them to the room and leaned against a wall while he waited. The cold of the stones seeped into his shoulder. Arya stopped in front of the fourth archway. The now familiar cadence of her recitation rose and fell like a soft sigh of wind. Again, nothing. A faint tickling on the back of his right hand caused Aragorn to look down. A huge wingless cricket clung to his glove. The insect was hideous, black and bulbous, with barbed legs and a massive skull-like head. Its carapace gleamed like oil.
Aragorn shuddered, his skin crawling, and shook his arm, flinging the cricket into the darkness. It landed with an audible thump. The fifth corridor proved no more fruitful for Arya than the preceding four. She bypassed the opening where Aragorn stood and stationed herself in front of the seventh archway. Before she could cast her spell, a guttural yowl echoed down the corridors, seemingly from all directions at once. Then there was a hiss and a spat and a screech that made every hair on Aragorn's body stand on end. Angela whirled around.
Solemnbum!
As one, the four of them drew their blades. Aragorn backed into the center of the room, his gaze darting from one archway to the next. His Gedwe Ignazia itched and tingled like a flea bite, a useless warning, for it did not tell him where or what the danger was.
This way, said Arya, moving toward the seventh archway.
The herbalist refused to budge.
No,
she whispered vehemently.
We have to help him.
Aragorn noticed that she held a short sword with a strange, colourless blade that flashed gem-like in the light. Arya scowled.
If Murtagh learns we're here, we'll...
It happened so quickly and silently, Aragorn would never have noticed had he not been looking in the right direction. A half-dozen doors, hidden within the walls of three different corridors, swung open, and 30 or so black-garbed men ran out toward them, swords in hand.
Let her!
Shouted Wirden, and the men in one group collided with each other as if those in front had run headlong into a wall. Then the rest of the attackers fell upon them, and there was no time for magic. Aragorn easily parried a stab, and with a looping backhanded stroke, sliced off the attacker's head. Like all the others, the man wore a kerchief tied over his face, so only his eyes were exposed, and the kerchief fluttered as the head fell spinning toward the floor. Aragorn was relieved when he felt Brisinga sink into flesh and blood. For a moment he had feared that their opponents were protected by spells or armor, or worse, that they were something other than human. He skewered another man through the ribs and had just turned to deal with two more of his attackers when a sword that should not have been there arced through the air toward his throat. His wards saved him from certain death, yet with the blade an inch away from his neck, Aragorn could not help but stumble back. To his astonishment, the man he had stabbed was still standing, blood streaming down his side, seemingly oblivious to the hole Aragorn had poked through him. Dread settled over Aragorn.
They can't feel pain, he shouted, even as he frantically blocked swords from three different directions.
If anyone heard him, they failed to respond. He wasted no more time talking, but concentrated on fighting the men in front of him, trusting his companions to protect his back. Aragorn lunged and parried and dodged, whipping Brisinga through the air as if it weighed no more than a switch. Ordinarily, he could have killed any of the men in an instant, but the fact that they were impervious to pain meant that he had to either behead them, stab them through the heart, or cut them and hold them off until loss of blood rendered them unconscious. Otherwise, the attackers kept trying to kill him, regardless of their injuries. The number of men made it difficult to evade all of their blows and strike back in return. He could have stopped defending himself and just let his wards protect him, but that would tire him just as quickly as springing Brisinga. And since he could not predict exactly when his wards would fail, as they must at a certain point, else they would kill him, and he knew he might need them later on, he fought just as carefully and cautiously as if he were facing men whose swords could kill or maim with a single stroke. More black-garbed warriors streamed out of the hidden doorways within the corridors. They crowded around Aragorn, pushing him back through sheer weight of numbers. Hands clung to his legs and arms, threatening to immobilize him.
Kvast,
he growled under his breath, uttering one of the 12 death words Oromis had taught him. As he had suspected, his spell had no effect. The men were warded against direct magical attacks. He quickly readied a spell Murtagh had once used on him. Thrister Vinder. It was a roundabout way of striking at the men, as he was not actually hitting them, but rather pushing the air against them. In any case, it worked. A howl of wind filled the chamber, clawing at Aragorn's hair and cloak, and sending the men closest to him, flying back into their compatriots, clearing a space of 10 feet in front of him. His strength decreased commensurately, but not enough to incapacitate him.
He turned to see how the others were doing. He had not been the first to find a way to circumvent the men's wards. Bolts of lightning extended from Weirden's right arm and wrapped themselves around any warrior unfortunate enough to pass in front of him. The glowing cables of energy appeared almost liquid as they writhed around their victims. Still more men were forcing their way into the room, however. "This way!" cried Arya, and sprang toward the seventh corridor, the one she had failed to examine before the ambush. Weirden followed, as did Aragorn. Angela brought up the rear, limping and clutching at a bloody cut on her shoulder. Behind them, the black-garbed men hesitated, milling in the chamber for a moment. Then with a mighty roar, they gave chase. As he sprinted down the corridor, Aragorn strove to compose a variation of his earlier spell that would allow him to kill the men instead of just knocking them away. He quickly devised one and held it in readiness to use as soon as he could see a fair number of the attackers. "Who are they?" he wondered. "How many of them are there?" Up ahead, he glimpsed an opening through which shone a faint, purplish light. He just had time to feel apprehensive about its source before the herbalist uttered a loud cry, and there was a dull orange flash and a teeth-jarring thud, and the smell of sulphur filled the air. Aragorn whirled around to see five men dragging the herbalist through a doorway that had opened in the side of the corridor. "No!" yelled Aragorn, but before he could stop it, the door swung shut as silently as it had opened, and the wall appeared perfectly solid once more. "Brisingr!" he shouted, and his sword erupted in flame. He placed the tip against the wall and attempted to push it through the stone, intending to cut open the door. The stone was thick, though, and slow to melt, and he soon realized it would take far more energy than he was willing to sacrifice. Then Arya appeared beside him, and she placed a hand where the door was and murmured, "Ladrin, open." The door remained stubbornly closed, but Aragorn was embarrassed he had not thought to try that first. Their pursuers were so close by now that he and Arya had no choice but to turn and face them. Aragorn wanted to cast the spell he had invented, but the corridor was only wide enough for two men to approach at a time. He would not be able to kill the rest, as they were hidden from sight. Better to keep the spell a secret, he decided, and save it for when he could wipe out most of the warriors at once. He and Arya beheaded the two lead men, then attacked the next pair of warriors as they stepped over the bodies. In quick succession, they killed six more men, but there seemed to be no end of them. "Through here!" shouted Weirden. "Stenner Slaughter!" exclaimed Arya, and all along the corridor, up to a few yards from where she stood, the stones in the walls exploded into the passageway. The hail of sharp fragments caused the black-clad men to cower and falter, and more than one fell to the floor, crippled. Together, Aragorn and Arya turned to follow Weirden, who was running toward the opening at the end of the corridor. The elf was only 30 feet away from it, then 10, then 5. And then a thicket of amethyst spikes shot out of holes in the floor and the ceiling, catching Weirden between them. The elf seemed to float in the middle of the corridor, the spikes less than an inch away from his skin as his wards repelled the crystal thorns. Then a crackling discharge of energy ran the length of each spike, and the needle-sharp tips flared painfully bright, and with an unpleasant crunch, they slid home. Weirden screamed and thrashed, and then his weirlight went out, and he moved no more. Aragorn stared with disbelief as he stumbled to a stop before the spikes. For all his experience in battle, he had never before been present at the death of an elf. Weirden and Blodgarm and the rest of their cohort were so accomplished, Aragorn had believed that the only way they were likely to die was while fighting either Galbatorix or Murtagh. Arya appeared equally stunned. She rallied quickly, however. "Aragorn," she said in an urgent voice, "cut us a path with Brisingr." He understood. His sword, unlike hers, would be impervious to whatever evil magic the spikes contained. He drew back his arm and swung as hard as he could. A half dozen of the spikes shattered beneath Brisingr's adamantine edge.